right, let's rewind to Denmark, 2005. In a small lab at Danisco, a group of yogurt scientists are staring at vats of spoiled milk, millions of euros in product literally down the drain. Their Streptococcus thermophilus cultures, the bacteria that make yogurt possible, were dying off in batches, whole production lines collapsing overnight. It sounds like something out of a corporate thriller, but it was real. And for them, it was a full-blown crisis.
And there's something almost absurd about it, isn't there? You've got this massive industrial operation, stainless steel tanks, precision machinery, global supply chains, and the whole thing grinds to a halt because of a virus that infects bacteria, a bacteriophage. But that's what makes it such a human story. A business crisis forcing scientists to realize that bacteria had basically invented pattern recognition.
Yeah, Rodolphe Barangu and Philippe Horvath, the scientists at Danisco, started combing through the few bacteria that had somehow survived. They expected to find something ordinary, some kind of random mutation or standard resistance mechanism. Nothing revolutionary, just the usual Darwinian luck.
But what they found was astonishing. The survivors weren't just resistant. They'd taken fragments of the virus's DNA, almost like keepsakes, and stitched them into their own genome. It was biological memory in its purest form.
Exactly. Imagine clipping a mugshot of the intruder and filing it away for next time. That's essentially how CRISPR works. The bacteria store fragments of the virus's DNA, and when it shows up again, they use that record to recognize and destroy it. The guide RNA is the mugshot, and the Cas proteins are the molecular scissors. Unbelievably precise, almost unnervingly so.
But the part that really gets me is this. They didn't evolve by staying untouched. They evolved by letting the virus in. Exposure wasn't a flaw. It was the feature. If you want to be adaptive, you can't avoid disruption. You have to learn to metabolize it.
It kind of flips our whole idea of survival, doesn't it? The same thing happens with organizations or people. If you spend all your time avoiding disruption, you never build the muscles to adapt. And honestly, that's kind of comforting. It means resilience isn't about staying safe. It's about learning through contact.
It is. And what's fascinating is that this pattern, learning through exposure, isn't limited to biology. You see the same kind of adaptive intelligence in culture. Think about Detroit Techno. It came out of a city that once powered American manufacturing and then watched that whole system collapse. But the creative energy didn't disappear, it rerouted. Across the river, Canadian college radio was spinning Kraftwerk and early European imports, while the electrifying Mojo was broadcasting them back into Detroit's night air. Kids in Belleville, Juan Atkins, Derek May, Kevin Saunderson, started fusing those machine rhythms with the funk and soul they'd grown up on. And at the same time, Detroit hardcore was translating the same post-industrial tension into stripped-down aggression. Both scenes were doing what those bacteria did, metabolizing disruption, turning collapse into code. That's cultural intelligence, not purity, but synthesis, seeing how fragments reorganize into something coherent. So this is the bridge. Ideas and DNA behave in surprisingly similar ways. I know it sounds like the setup for a TED talk, but it's true. Both replicate, mutate, and recombine as they move through their own kinds of networks. The same viral logic shapes evolution and culture.
Exactly. That's what culture mapping is built for. It blends semiotics with data tracking, watching how words, images, and rituals move through a culture. You can actually see ideas spreading, mutating, and bumping into resistance. It's like tracing the epidemiology of meaning itself.
Right. You start to see which ideas are thriving and which ones the culture is starting to reject. It's almost like watching an immune system at work, accepting some signals, fighting off others.
Exactly. And here's the part that always surprises people. About 10% of the human genome is viral in origin. We're literally built from infection. Our cells are the record of viruses that didn't just invade, but stayed and became part of us. We're post-viral by design.
Yeah, endosymbiosis. About 2 billion years ago, a single-celled organism got infected by a kind of bacteria. But instead of dying, they merged. That partnership became mitochondria, the little engines in our cells that make it possible for us to breathe. So even at the deepest level of life, it's remixing all the way down.
It's such a powerful metaphor for culture. Language, fashion, music, none of them evolve in straight lines. Take the word stan. It starts in rap, gets picked up in online fandoms, and before long, it's in a marketing campaign. That's not linear adoption. It's lateral transfer, the same logic microbes use when they swap genes.
Right. And it's the same principle we saw in Detroit. Those musicians weren't inventing from scratch. They were metabolizing everything around them. European synth experiments, black funk traditions, the industrial noise of a collapsing economy. What made it revolutionary wasn't originality in the pure sense, it was synthesis. The ability to take dissonant materials and find coherence in them. That's the pattern you see across evolution, whether it's cells or cultures, transformation through contact.
Exactly. Contamination as collaboration. Once you start looking for it, you see it everywhere in how we make, how we speak, how we connect. So if we really want to see how this viral logic plays out in culture, authenticity might be the most contagious idea of the 21st century. In the early 2000s, everything was artisanal. Farmers' markets, microbreweries, handmade soap, local cheese. Authenticity meant you could trace the source. It was material, transparent, and very consciously against mass production.
Then the mutation hits. Fashion and marketing swoop in and grab the word authentic. Suddenly you've got authentic vintage, authentically distressed denim. The meaning slides from describing a process to describing a surface. It's no longer about origin or craft, it's just the look of the thing.
Totally. Then Silicon Valley gets hold of it. Authentic connection. Authentic experiences. By 2015, the word's everywhere, in Instagram captions, Airbnb listings, startup decks. Authenticity isn't about tracing where something comes from anymore. It's about feeling real, even if just for a few seconds while you scroll.
Culture mapping actually caught this in real time. The word authentic started showing up everywhere. Food, fashion, tech, self-help. Even in places where it didn't make sense anymore. That's what oversaturation looks like. Like a virus replicating too fast, the system reacts, the culture starts to push it out.
Exactly. It turns into performance. By 2017, authenticity starts to feel hollow, and people begin mocking it. The backlash spreads fast. Irony becomes a kind of defense mechanism. The word fractures, still sincere in some spaces, pure parody in others, and in the gaps, new codes emerge. Transparency, vulnerability, anything that sounds less manufactured.
Exactly. You can see the full cycle. Emergence, adoption, saturation, immune response. It's straight out of virology. Even ideas seem to trigger antibodies once they've spread too far.
And it's never just about the word itself. It's about how people feel around it, how psychology reacts collectively. Culture mapping doesn't just trace the mutation, it reads the emotional tone around it. Computational linguistics lets us see that shift, how the language around a term moves from admiration to irony, or from excitement to exhaustion. You can literally watch the sentiment change. It's kind of beautiful, and a little ruthless too, the way culture keeps editing itself. This gets to how we actually process change. Steven Pinker talks about two modes of thinking, the reality mindset and the mythology mindset. The reality mindset is about evidence, logic, what's happening in front of us. The mythology mindset is about story and belonging, the shared narratives that hold a group together, even if they're not literally true.
Absolutely, you need both. Think about cypherpunks and cyberpunk in the early 90s. You've got the cypherpunks, Tim May, Eric Hughes, John Gilmore, meeting in San Francisco in 92, launching their mailing list, writing code for encryption and privacy, and then you've got the cyberpunk writers, Gibson's Neuromancer, Sterling's Mirror Shades, imagining futures where technology becomes rebellion. Different worlds, same moment. The activists were inspired by the fiction, and the fiction was exploring what the coders were building. Structure and myth. Reality and narrative. They weren't inventing from scratch. They were remixing what was already there. Machines, networks, cryptography, counterculture. That's pattern recognition. That's cultural intelligence.
Exactly. You need the reality mindset to keep the machine running, to deal with what's right in front of you. But the mythology mindset gives it meaning. It answers why any of it matters beyond survival. Even the idea of productivity has evolved. It used to mean output per hour. Now it's tied to wellness, sustainability, mindfulness. It's becoming a kind of modern myth about balance and worth.
It's not that we're being irrational. We're just adjusting the cultural metabolism. Sometimes a society needs a new story for the same process. But it gets risky when those two modes blur. When political tribes treat identity myths like data, or when companies try to engineer belief as if culture were all logic and no feeling.
Yeah, that's the point where culture starts to go off the rails. Foresight, or what we do with culture mapping, is really about reading which mindset is in play. Once you can tell that, you start to see what's actually happening, not just what people say is happening. I think that's the real literacy of modern life.
Let's ground this in something real. Patagonia's 2011 Don't Buy This Jacket campaign. It's Black Friday, the biggest shopping day of the year, and they take out a full-page ad in the New York Times telling people not to buy their product. For most companies, that would sound completely mad.
What's wild is that Patagonia actually let the sustainability trend in. They didn't fight the contagion. They metabolized it. They ran it through their own DNA. Instead of copying the new codes, they filtered them, refined them, and made the disruption part of their identity.
Right, that's selective permeability, the same strategy bacteria use. You don't seal yourself off, but you don't let everything in either. Patagonia did the same thing. They published the carbon footprint of their products, expanded their repair program, even celebrated people wearing patched-up gear. They didn't deny the infection, indeed they managed it. They turned vulnerability into value.
And that's the thing, it's not that Patagonia's perfect, they've faced more recent scrutiny too, especially as sustainability itself has become a kind of industry. But the difference is they stayed in the conversation. It's the opposite of brands that either lock themselves in a time capsule or chase every new trend until no one remembers what they stand for. Patagonia took risks, got a little messy, but kept hold of who they were.
Exactly, just like CRISPR systems. The goal isn't to wipe out every virus. It's to recognize, remember, and integrate what's useful so the next encounter builds strength. That's cultural immunity, adaptation, through exposure, not withdrawal.
This is where a lot of organizations get it wrong. They treat innovation like a calendar event, something you can plan for with targets and forecasts. But real change doesn't arrive on schedule. It moves sideways, from the margins, often where no one's looking.
Exactly, and let's be honest. The breakthrough at Danisco wasn't on anyone's roadmap to revolutionize medicine. They were just trying to fix a yogurt problem. But that's how the big stuff usually happens. The real breakthroughs don't come from prediction. They bubble up from the edges, from people solving something small that turns out to matter enormously.
Which is really what culture mapping does. It's not about prophecy. It's about listening in real time to where language and meaning are shifting. You start to see early signals, like when a word such as productivity suddenly appears next to mental health. That's how you catch a code rewriting itself before anyone else realizes it's happening.
Pattern literacy is really the skill. It's like jazz. You learn the standards so you can recognize them and then bend them when the moment calls for it. That's what innovation actually is. Memory made deliberate. Memory made conscious.
When you see it that way, foresight stops being about control and starts being about adaptive intelligence. It's not prediction, it's perception and memory. Think of it like computational linguistics. We're building taxonomies of meaning, watching how certain words or ideas cluster and recombine. The way a bag of words reveals shifting relationships over time. Culture works the same way. Like bacteria archiving every viral encounter, we're constantly tagging and storing experience so it can be reused, turning exposure into strategy.
We're always adding to the collective codebook, one disruption at a time. The organizations that understand that, that can spot a mutation while it's still on the fringe, those are the ones that adapt. They don't chase change, they learn from it.
So when you boil it down, the lesson isn't about avoiding infection. It's about remembering. That's literally what kept those yogurt bacteria alive. They didn't build walls, they built memory. They survived by turning disruption into intelligence.
And that's what culture does at its best. It turns friction, exposure, even backlash into new forms of knowing. Every cycle we've talked about points to that. Endosymbiosis. Life integrating what once threatened it. The mutation of authenticity, meaning evolving until it exhausts itself and begins again. Patagonia's openness. Taking risk as a form of integrity. Even our shifting ideas of productivity, redefining what it means to create value without burning out. It's all code, continually rewriting itself. And through that rewriting, we keep discovering new ways to stay alive and to stay connected.
Innovation isn't magic or invention out of nowhere. It's pattern recognition, learning to read the code as it keeps changing. Every remix, every meme, every viral idea adds another sequence to our collective CRISPR, another way of remembering who we are through what we've absorbed.
It means you're going to be exposed to culture's mutations. That's inevitable. The real question is whether you're building the capacity to metabolize them. Because that's where future resilience lives, not in protection, but in transformation.
And I think that image of the surviving bacteria really says it all. Vulnerable enough to be changed, but smart enough to remember what matters. That's the balance, isn't it? Pattern literacy, selective permeability, the courage to let in just enough chaos to keep evolving.
Exactly. Innovation is really just integration, bringing in what's new without losing what still works. Life moves forward through exchange, not isolation.
All right, everyone. Thanks for joining us for this little exchange of code. We'll be back soon to mutate another set of ideas. Simon, always a pleasure.
Absolute pleasure, Angela. Goodbye, everyone. And until next time, keep your membranes open but your sense of self intact.